and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The date today is December 9th, 2022, and this is episode 358. I'm the host, Mark Ames, still in Rochester, gonna be here for a while probably, and I'm on the line with John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, a.k.a. the Warnerd, in Trieste. Actually, John, how much longer are you going to be there, or is that a secret for now? Or
no, it's not a secret. I guess we'll be here for another month. I'll be sad to leave. I love Trieste. I wish I'd been healthier when I was here, but I wasn't able to enjoy it as much as I could have. Just starting to get a little healthier now, and it's just a wonderful city. It's a bit like San Francisco, and it's cooler. It's got a
without
very accessible,
tech bros.
Yeah, no tech bros here.
Yeah.
And a weird ethnic mix, which is why I've been looking at D'Annunzio and the whole Friulia expedition. I mean, D'Annunzio is, of course, the 20th century Italian poet, and he, when Rijeka, Croatian city, which is now called Rijeka, was then called Fiume.
Fiume.
An Italian city, when it was not annexed by Italy after World War I, because Italy had these big hopes. It's like, look, we joined the winning side. We lost over a million people. We got to get something out of this. Much like, I suppose you could say, much like the Freikorps in Eastern Europe, tried to expand into the eastern shore of the Adriatic, but it's not quite like that. I mean, there it was an extraordinary movement, and I think you can't oversimplify these early 20th century movements too much. I mean, it drew radical artists from Japan, the United States, the UK, Italy, all over. Strange army of artists, and granted, artists can be crazy, but
yes,
and they were very more than 20th. They were very 21st century people. They the constitution for this abortive Friulia Republic was in favor of workers' rights, invalid pension, universal suffrage, freedom of opinion, religion, and sexual orientation, which was a surprise. That was not common at the time. Decriminalization of homosexuality, nudism, drug use, and a lot of very strange stuff. And there was this tremendous emphasis on newness. There was a whole class of people. The place was divided into 10 guilds. One of them was the very new men. Everybody was going to be new, but these guys were going to be very new. And yeah, there were a lot of fascist overtones, but there were a lot of other interesting tones in there too.
We should do an episode. In fact, I wonder if we can get an Ebelay to do that. I know we talked about D'Annunzio some with him, but it's worth an episode. It's so weird and so interesting. And I mean, I think it's better known as an influence on Mussolini, certainly the uniform part. I mean, the artist fashion statement stuff. But it's not that simple, right? And
Mussolini bombed that republic out of existence in the 1920s.
Yeah, I always wondered how much D'Annunzio might have even influenced Limonov's political. It seems right up kind of his alley.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But I don't ever recall talking with Limonov at all about D'Annunzio. I should ask some of his old friends about that. some of his old writer artist friends. But anyway, but first we need to do that episode and get into who he was and that whole world. It was after World War One, it was a very strange,
a much
world.
Wilder time than the time we're in. And I think that's hard for people to understand because they have this sense that history gets wilder as it goes on. Not by any means. 1920, that was a wild time.
Yeah, that was right at the same year they were having the the something Rosa. It, basically, when Italy almost went red, and a lot of factories were taken over. I mean, things were wild then. Right. So today we're going to be talking with a friend of the show and previous guest, Joshua Landis, Syria expert. To get the latest on the war there, I mean, the Syria war was the war when we first launched this podcast. It was the story, and it was sort of like, then it was sort of like, how do we get away from Syria for a while and do other episodes? Mm. Kind of, you know, Ukraine is more front and center than Syria was, but Syria was definitely the front center story in the previous decade.
It's faded. It's been replaced. You know, it's a star is born in media terms. And that star is the Ukraine war.
But it links up in ways, you know, as we'll find out when we talk with Joshua. I mean, it's tied into the fortunes of the Ukraine war, and it hasn't gone away. And, you know, things are sort of happening there. So, we want to check up on that by the end of the year. I don't want to get into the latest Ukraine-Russia stuff. The only thing I would say, it was kind of interesting that the U.S. traded, the U.S. and Russia organized that trade, which has been in the works clearly for quite a while, between the former women's basketball star, Brittany Griner, and very infamous Russian arms trafficker Viktor Bout, and that trade was finally just affected, I think, yesterday as we record this. But they've still left a couple. I don't know who else the U.S. has who's very high profile, but people are talking about there's another, I think, an American teacher who also got arrested for something, medical marijuana. Mm. I mean,
Whalen, is that?
No, that's the different one. And as Paul Whalen, I mean, you know, talking honestly about it, it's not going to decide his fate. The Russian government knows what it knows. Whalen is clearly, if not a spy, some kind of contractor or spy adjacent. I mean, they found out he had four different citizenships. You know, not everybody has four citizenships. And the way the U.S. handled him from the time he was first caught, the way official Washington handled him in the peak of the whole Russiagate thing, was sort of like, we don't talk about this. I mean, it was very different from anything else. And they were like that from the start. He was caught red-handed. He was set up in a sting by the FSB and caught red-handed. And I don't, you know, I'm not an intelligence expert in how they sort of structure things. But I would imagine if he was a real officer, like a real made man officer at Langley, that they would have talked a lot more about him and put in a lot more effort to get him free. But there are so many sort of outer layers of the CIA, contractors and freelancers and this and that and the other. And who knows, maybe he was doing something on the side that for a different client that the U.S. maybe wasn't involved in or maybe even didn't approve of.
Yeah, my few encounters with people who I'm pretty sure were spy-y is you don't realize how many stringers there are.
Yes.
People just either they're dumbass willing volunteers or they get a tiny bit of money or something, or they get to have a special badge which they can show on dates or something. All kinds of stupid stuff like that. Yeah. And they're not very good at it either.
Yeah, it always kind of surprises me how little they – I guess they just don't think they're really putting things at risk. You know, like they'll get the usual – if you're caught, you know, we never met you sort of thing. Yeah. You know, I've seen that in the movies. You always say that, but it's like,
yeah,
no,
but you'll come after me.
Exactly.
Charlie Sheen in Hot Shots Part 2 or something.
Yeah. All right. So anyway, also a potential future episode, I think somebody had suggested Viktor Bout. I mean, it is interesting and maybe just sort of big times arms traffickers like that. Arms traffickers not named, you know, hi, I'm from the CIA, because it's not like this. I love how they talk about them like an arms trafficker. Can you imagine such a thing? Like, what the hell do you think the U.S. is? Anyway.
Yeah.
All right. So let's get to our interview with Joshua Landis and get the latest on the Syrian war. Okay. We are really excited to welcome back to the podcast, Professor Joshua Landis. He's the director of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and really the premier expert on Syria in the West, as far as we've known, gotten the story more right than anybody I've seen out there, and so we're really excited to have him back on the show. He just for archive purposes, if you want to go back and listen to his previous interviews with us, Radio Warnerd episode 118. That was when Turkey first was invading Afrin in 2018. Radio Warnerd episode 150 on Idlib and the Syria endgame. And then at the beginning of this year, we caught up with Professor Landis about, you know, sort of where the Syria war was. And this, of course, is before the Ukraine war. So first of all, thank you for coming on. Welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you so much. It's great to be with you. And I really enjoy your show and your smart commentary.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Yeah, we really appreciate you being here, because although things have not stopped happening in Syria at their usual frenetic rate, most of the world has stopped paying attention to them because Ukraine has absorbed all the oxygen in the proverbial room, Mr. Lebowski. So, yeah, we need an update.
Yeah. So, you know, the last time we talked a lot about the immiseration, you know, just the misery that the population was living in. The kind of hook was an ISIS prison attack or uprising in Osaka.
Right,
which was under SDF control, right? And so I guess if you could update us first by sort of talking about maybe what has changed and maybe what has sort of stayed on the same wretched course or whatever.
Well, two big things have changed. And that is, the Ukraine war mm-hmm. has given Turkey much more leverage.
Right.
Secondly, there was the November 19th bombing in Istanbul that Turkey and Erdogan has attributed to the YPG. These are Kurdish forces in Syria that are allied with the Turkish Workers Party, the PKK, which mm-hmm. Turkey sees as a mortal enemy. Mm-hmm. It is an organization that has traditionally looked to build a Kurdish state in eastern Anatolia and wants independence for Kurds. That position has been modified over the years, but Turkey still sees them as a terrorist organization. The United States does too, the PKK. But the YPG, which is the Kurdish forces in Syria that are allied with America, are a client militia, really. That America has built a force called, they've named it the Syrian Democratic Forces, SDF, but its major component is this YPG, these Kurdish forces. And Turkey looks at this American alliance with the Syrian Kurds as inimical to them, because those Syrian Kurds are allied with the Kurdish, with the Turkish Kurds. And by arming them, training them, and building them up as an independent force in Syria, Turkey sees this as really a sort of mortal blow against Turkey. And it has driven animosity between several U.S. administrations and Erdogan's Turkey over the last decade. So Turkey wants to see the Americans largely driven out of Syria, so that they will not arm and supply these Kurds. And that's what Turkey is has used this terrorist attack on November 19th in Istanbul by YPG-related Syrians as an excuse to really demand that the United States withdraw from the border, and it says it's going to attack. There are three main places that it says it will go into, and that's right along this whole 500-kilometer border that Syria has with Turkey. One place is in Tel Rifat, which is the furthest west. Another, Menbij and Kobani, which are all forces that are largely controlled by the YPG. And so America has promised that it will not withdraw under President Biden. But it might be that the United States has to make some concessions to Turkey on this. And that could be, you know, to allow the Kurds to be hit. And we'll have to see. So the drama is building up, and both sides are putting forces along the border, and there's a lot of saber rattling going on.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I guess, quick question. Do you think there's anything to, I mean, it would seem to me, I don't know, illogical and kind of crazy for the YPG to have set off a bomb in a marketplace, you know, in like a year before Erdogan's presidential campaign. Is there real serious evidence that the YPG did that?
It looks like Turkey has been dribbling out more and more information. At first, they immediately jumped to conclusions, but it looks like these are Syrian Kurds that are involved. And how much they're connected and whether there was any order given. And the YPG and the Syrian Democratic Forces have been repeating over and over again, we have nothing to do with this, we didn't give the orders, and so forth. Turkey is insisting that these people are connected in one way or the other, and that this underlines what a threat this whole Kurdish enclave is in northern Syria. And so we're unlikely to get any real light on this. And it, in some ways, it doesn't matter because Erdogan has been on the warpath now for a long time about this whole issue. And he's, whether it's true or he's just using it as a pretext, it's hard to know. But, you know, we look at, he's made three major incursions into Syria in the past 7 years, one in 2016, one in 2018, and most recently in 2019. And he says he wants a buffer zone of 30 kilometers along this entire border. And he's built a buffer zone in about half of it. But there's another half that hasn't. And that's what he's gunning for.
It seems that Erdogan is in this strange position, or the Turkish state is in this strange position. They probably do have the military force to push that 30 kilometers into Syria. But there's this bizarre web of alliances, including the United States alliance with Turkey, which usually trumps everything. But the United States has also been involved in long-term destabilization efforts in Syria, and the YPG or SDF was the ground force behind that. So the most cynical attitude in the world, the United States has a complicated problem.
It does. And if we look at it, you know, if we look at the relationship between the United States and the Kurds in Syria, particularly the YPG, that relationship was built in 2014 and 15 when ISIS became this major force in northern Syria and Iraq. And for a long time, the United States had watched ISIS build up in 2013 and Al-Qaeda at the beginning of the Syrian uprising, thinking that Assad, they would, in a sense, terrorize Assad's forces and be leverage for the United States to force Assad to come to the United States to make a deal and cause Assad to leave, at which point America would be able to ask the Syrian army to kick Assad out of the country and depose him. Something like what happened in Egypt. And that never happened, of course. ISIS just got bigger and bigger, and Russia eventually stepped in. And America jettisoned its Arab allies, its Syrian opposition forces, and switched to the Kurds, because the Kurds were willing to fight ISIS. So at some point, Assad was no longer the main enemy of the United States, even though the United States had been building up forces to fight Assad for years and saying we want him to go. They switched in around 2014-15 and said, you know, ISIS is our main enemy. And in order to get ISIS, they teamed up with Syria's Kurds, about 10% of the Syrian population. But the trouble is, for the Kurds, is that ISIS has been largely destroyed today. They're still an insurgency, and they're hit-and-run operations, but it's not the kind of territorial force that that frightened America and that was attacking Western interests. So today, the Kurds have little leverage, and Turkey has gained tremendous amount of leverage because of the Ukraine war. And so Turkey sees this as their chance to push in to Syria, create this buffer zone. And that means the United States is in this awkward position. Even though it's promised that it would not leave Syria, its alliance with the Kurds is much less important today. And so for the Biden administration, this really presents a dilemma. They don't want to leave Syria and like they did Afghanistan, which would be a big reputational damage to the United States. But they might be willing to cough up this border zone.
And what would that do? That would presumably then give Erdogan everything he wants regarding Syria?
It would give him a lot. It would certainly, you see, what he's saying to his people is, we have 4 million Arab refugees, Syrian refugees in Turkey. If we build this border zone, we can kick out the YPG, which threatens us, and we can put in and resettle these Arab refugees in this buffer zone. So it'll create an ethnic buffer zone. They can ethnically cleanse Kurds and build up an Arab population. And Turkey, you see, has supported in these areas that it's already taken as buffer zones, it has built up a force that it calls the Syrian National Army, the SNA, which is made up of dozens of militias that used to fight Assad and are now have become proxies for Turkey. And Turkey uses them to rule the areas that it has conquered. They're very anti-Kurd. And they want to set up a really an alternative state to Assad. And so Turkey is using those Arab forces, Arab Sunni forces, against the Kurds in this territory. And there's really a struggle over who controls this region, Kurds or Arabs. And Turkey is sided with the Arabs, and America is sided with the Kurds. But America is stepping back from its commitment to the Kurds in order to run other operations like the Ukraine war, for which it needs Turkey a lot.
We were talking before the show, wondering if the YPG threat, or, well, what I would guess is a threat. Officially, it was a notification that they might no longer be able to guard Islamic State prisoners. If that's really a threat, like, okay, if you drive us out, we're going to let these very scary people go.
Well, that's been a main that has been a main argument that they're using, that America uses against Turkey, to try to say, Turkey, don't do this. It's going to reactivate ISIS. These prisoners, of which there are about 70,000, 60 to 70,000 still, most of them are women and children, oddly enough, but there are about 10,000 fighters that are still held in these prisons, and the rest are families, many very young children. And That's a big problem. The thing is, the United States could allow for this border zone and keep the prisons further inland, which, you know, which Turkey is probably counting on. And this way, the YPG would lose some of its most important territories and population concentrations. And it would be kicked back into this Arab part of the desert near Euphrates. And it would be very, it would be a death by 100, you know, cuts is what would happen. It'd be a slow, you know, slow loss of territory for the Kurds. And that's what's been happening as Turkey pushes in.
How is Afrin a kind of model for this, or this area, that the one area they have taken, buffer zone area, sort of more in the central north?
Right. Afrin, it was an area that was dominated by the YPG and Kurdish majority area with about 300,000 Kurds living in it. Turkey, with its proxy Arab militias, conquered that area. About 200,000 of the Kurds fled further towards Aleppo and now populate a bunch of villages. But the Afrin, Turkey has been building housing. It's kicked out and disappeared a lot of Kurds, but it's resettled Arab refugees in that area. And it becomes, as you say, it's a model for what could happen in Menbij and Kobani and Ain al-Arab and other places that Turkey says it's going to attack next. And just today, the Syrian military has sent a big convoy with about 1,500 troops and tanks up north towards Tel Rifat, and the Russians have been moving some troops up there. The Americans, just a few days ago, reestablished these border patrols with the Kurds in order to try to put American troops on the border so that Turkey won't attack, because they would possibly kill Americans, and that would, you know, just be another layer of defense. So America is saying, don't do this. Russia is saying, don't do this. The Syrian government is saying, don't do this. But Turkey has recently thrown another little curveball into the mix here. And Erdogan has said, you know, I will sit down with Assad and we can make peace. There are no permanent enemies amongst neighbors. And we can work this out. Mm. And if you put Syrian troops on the border, backed by Russia, and get rid of the YPG, we could negotiate that with Assad. And Russia has said, you know, to the Kurds, if you back up and allow us to move in there with a Syrian army, it'll save you a lot of grief and ethnic cleansing. And that's the way we can solve this. Now, that puts America on the hot seat, because America can say to the YPG, to its allies, the Kurdish allies, do what Russia and Assad says.
Yeah.
And you'll save yourself, or we'll back you up.
It's as if the Kurds have finally sort of woken up to the fact that they're a bargaining chip for the United States. It's like, I read an article recently, I think it was posted on your Twitter, about the seven betrayals of the Kurds in the 20th century by the U.S. And I mean, when you're trying to set up an independent state that has no coastline and is in a very fraught, important part of the world, you don't have much reason to trust anybody. And especially when you're supposed to be withdrawing from a place like Kobani, which was a sacred site, really. I mean, the YPG stand in Kobani was like that, one of the few happy stories of 2014, as I remember it. And it must be very, very difficult to give that up.
It is. And, you know, Kobani is a city right on the border with Turkey and Syria. It was a Kurdish majority city, about 200 and some odd thousand people. And ISIS attacked them in 2014 and was just obliterating them. And Turkey was sitting there watching, and in fact, it helped some of the ISIS troops because it wanted to see the Kurds driven out of Kobani. America forced to issue. This is when America jumped in on the side of the Kurds against ISIS and began to formulate its relationship with Syria's Kurds as a proxy army. And so America began to arm them and drop in weapons and so forth and give them some artillery and bombed ISIS with its planes, much to the chagrin of Turkey, but Turkey was forced to go along with it. And so it became the seminal battle in which the Kurds successfully drove out ISIS, stopped this obliteration, and reestablished the city. The city was leveled, but it's been being rebuilt. But that's where Erdogan has made that a centerpiece of this new incursion, is we're going to push them out of there. So it would be devastating to the Kurds to have that lost. It would destroy their morale, because that was the calling card. It was where America really helped them out. And if America didn't step forward and say, you can't do that, it would be a true sign that America has really abandoned them and is going to let them, you know, let them go. And that, you know, the Kurds, as you mentioned, that's happened times before. The most famous was in the 1970s when the United States and Iran supplied the Kurds of northern Iraq with arms and so forth to put pressure on Saddam Hussein because they wanted to negotiate a treaty along the Shatt al-Arab. That's where the Euphrates and Tigris River come together, right on the border with Iran. And Iran wanted the border to be right in the middle of the river. And the United States and Iraq wanted it to be on the far side of the river so that the entire river would be owned by Iraq, which made sense. But Iran wanted to, you know, push in, and the United States backed it up, and they backed up the Kurds as their leverage power to as their cat's paw against Saddam, and Saddam had to give in to this. And then America, once Saddam signed the peace treaty, America abandoned the Kurds, and Saddam went after them, and this is when you get some terrible massacres. And the Kurds felt completely stabbed in the back. And it was a famous saying by Kissinger, who said, when he was confronted with this, he said, look, foreign policy is not a charitable organization.
He had a lot of wonderful little comments like that.
Yes, he did.
I guess one of the problems I have trying to figure out what's going on is, like, it seems like, it seems natural in the long run that Erdogan would try to make a deal with Assad and Assad's Russian allies. But why wouldn't the YPG or the SDF do the same thing? And why wouldn't Assad want to make a deal with the SDF? Are they just too bitterly opposed to do that?
You know, I think they will end up doing that. It's exactly what will happen is, for the Kurds, living under Damascus is much better than living under Turkish rule, because the Turks will ethnically cleanse them. Syria and the Assad regime is essentially a minoritarian regime. It depends on Syria's minorities a great deal. It's not totally minoritarian, but the top military leadership and security leadership is largely Alawite, Christian, Druze, other religious minorities who are fearful that should the Sunni Arab forces conquer Damascus, that they could be ethnically cleansed or driven into the margins of Syrian society. And so that's what keeps them together. And the Kurds, being a minority, 10% of the country, they are Sunni Muslims, but they are an ethnic minority.
Right.
The Kurds are naturally apart of this minoritarian regime. And the Assad regime has is the one that invited the YPG to set up offices in Damascus in the 1970s. It has supported them against Turkey in the past.
The PKK, you mean?
Yeah. The PKK, yes. Yeah, yeah. And sorry, I should say the PKK, not the YPG. But of course, at that time, they're all one.
Right.
I do believe that the Kurds will have to come and make a deal with Assad. The problem with that for the Kurds is that the Kurds want their own military force. They would like to replicate in northern Syria what the Kurds of northern Iraq have. And the Kurds of northern Iraq have a sort of quasi-independence.
Right.
Their Peshmerga forces rule northern Iraq, and the Iraqi army is not allowed in. Their schools teach only Kurdish. Kurds younger than 40 years old no longer speak Arabic. Many of them don't. Right. So this is what the Kurds would like to have in northeastern Syria, is their own autonomous region, which would be policed and patrolled by their own forces and would not have Syrian army in there. When America first beat ISIS several years ago, I wrote a long article on Syria Comet in which I said, America should not try to build up an independent force here and should not give the Kurds the belief that they're going to do this, that they're going to stick with them forever, because eventually America's going to be driven out of here because they just don't have the interests, and the Kurds are going to be abandoned. And they need to face reality, which is that they have to come to terms with Assad. And I think that's what's going to happen. The Kurds are beginning to realize it, but it's going to be a heavy blow to their aspirations, their desire for autonomy, and they've been treated badly by the Arabs, whether it's the Assad regime or the opposition Arabs. And they, this has been the problem for Kurds throughout the region, who never got their own nation state, whether it's Kurds in Turkey or in Iran, where there's a big Kurdish minority. And we have to, Mahsa Amini, the Iranian woman who was killed to start this big uprising in Iran, was Kurdish.
Yeah.
And the Kurds have been one of the areas, Kurdish part of Iran has been one of the areas that have lost the most people. Because it's mixed not only with women's rights and anti-regime, but there is an element, an ethnic element to that uprising. And the regime, the Iranian regime, has been meaner to the Kurds. In the same way that Syrian and have been meaner to Kurds in Syria, because they're fearful that they'll make this move towards autonomy. So that's the dilemma, that the Kurds are really caught between Turkey, which is much more brutal, but a Syrian regime, which is also very discriminatory.
Yeah.
Do we know what the Americans are saying to the SDF, the YPG, about whether or not America is okay with them talking to Assad, coming to an agreement with Assad and Russia, or are they saying don't?
We don't really know. I think the Americans are split on this. And there are some people in the administration, I think, that are trying to encourage the Kurds to talk to Assad. But at the same time, politically in America, we're so anti-Assad
and Putin
that we can't do this. We can't, we can't overtly. And there are lots of groups in the United States that don't want Assad to be re-legitimized in any way or expand his authority further north. They want to hurt him. And so they're trying to say, don't do this. And of course, Israel would like to see the United States remain in northern Syria. And a lot of Syrian opposition abroad want to keep Assad as weak as possible, because we have to remember that much of Syria's oil, which is not a lot, but it used to produce about 300,000 barrels a day, which was enough for Syria, is in the northeast. It's under the control of the Kurds and the United States. And the United States has been trying to keep the Kurds from selling it to Assad. And Syria's in deep, deep trouble today economically, primarily because it can't get oil. It doesn't have foreign currency to buy it. And the United States has been trying to keep it out through sanctions and through stopping shipping, foreign shipping to Syria. So Assad would love that oil. And America's trying to keep it out of his hands. So America has an interest in remaining in the region, but it doesn't really have an interest in fighting Turkey. And that leaves the Kurds very confused. And we just saw Mazlum Abadi, who is the head of the Syrian Democratic Forces, these are the main military that's allied with America, just wrote, a Kurdish leader, he wrote a long op-ed yesterday or the day before in the Washington Post saying, you know, we are America's best ally. Thousands of our troops died fighting ISIS. We have been with you every inch of the way. You can't abandon us now. You've got to stop the Turks. And I think that that call has some resonance still in Washington, mm-hmm. but how much when push comes to shove, I'm not sure.
It was really strange to see the Washington view, for example, of Michael Flynn, who was a paid agent of the Turkish state, but that didn't seem to come up much when the consensus in the media turned against him. It was more that he'd been somehow pro-Russian or something. And to the best
of my— He went to a dinner, an RT dinner or something, right?
Yeah, to the best of my knowledge, he wasn't getting paid by the Russian government. He was getting paid by the Turkish government, but that didn't register.
Right. Well, we've got this delicate relationship with Turkey, and mm-hmm. hanging in the balance right now is a big military deal for enhanced F-16s. Congress has just dropped objections, two major objections to this deal, in order to facilitate the sale of these jets to Turkey. And that's sitting on the table. And Turkey, America, I'm sure, is using that as leverage right now, saying to Turkey, don't invade Syria, or this could put the deal in jeopardy. The trouble is that America is trying to get both Finland and Sweden into NATO. Mm-hmm. And Turkey mm-hmm. can veto that entrance into NATO. And it's doing so. It's finding objections to it. So this is the wrangling that's going on, is arms sales versus enlarging NATO. And Turkey right. sits in the middle of this. And also, yeah. Turkey is, you know, all the wheat sales from Ukraine have to go through the Black Sea, where Turkey has a big presence. Russia has been doing its banking through Turkey, and America wants Turkey to shut off that main valve. And Turkey is talked about becoming an oil and gas center for Russian oil to get out, and America wants that to stop. Mm-hmm. So America needs Turkey to be an ally, to be a good ally. And Turkey's saying, we can be a good ally, but you can't arm these terrorists on our border. Mm. And that's the back and forth.
Right. Russia offered Turkey, somehow, this is from Al Jazeera, to withdraw the SDF from some of these border areas, the areas of Ain al-Arab and Manbij.
Right.
In exchange for Turkey not doing an actual kinetic invasion.
This is exactly what Russia wants. Russia wants to get the Syrian army back to the border. Russia has maintained from the beginning that Syrian national sovereignty and integrity has to be maintained. And both America and Turkey have repeated this line because, you know, international law says that you can't just cut up a country like Syria and create a new Turkish Kurdish state or an Arab Sunni enclave. So everybody theoretically agrees that Syria should be a sovereign nation. And so Russia is using that and saying, look, we want to return Syrian sovereignty to the border. And that's a way to bring Assad's army back to the Syrian border with Turkey. The Kurds don't want that because it's giving up their autonomy, but they may have to accept it. And much will depend on the United States. Mm-hmm. Will the United States say, no, don't accept that deal? Mm. Or will they say, you know, that's probably the best deal you're going to get. You have to accept it. And America doesn't want to say either thing. They're trying right. to head Turkey off at the pass and say, don't do this. But we'll see. Erdogan might just say, you know, that's not good enough. And this could be an opening for some kind of peace deal between Turkey and Syria and Assad.
Looking at it from the outside, it seems like that would be a better deal for the Syrian Kurds than to trust indefinitely in the United States, which could change its mind at any time and really doesn't have any strong commitment beyond permanent destabilization of any regimes that aren't in line with it.
I think you're absolutely right. The problem is the Kurds are clinging to hope that if America will back them for another year, two, three, that maybe Assad would fall. Maybe there'll be a public uprising in Syria. Maybe because America has been pushing Saudi Arabia and Qatar not to bring Syria back in and to rekindle relations. And it's been insisting to Middle Eastern allies, don't re-legitimize Assad. Mm. We need him to leave.
Have they had success with it? Because no, I remember this whole process.
It's not working.
It's not working. Okay.
Yes, but many, many Arab countries have re-established relations with Assad and are, but sanctions have cut trade. And what we just saw in southern Syria is a big public demonstration where it turned into a riot, where it turned into a bloodbath because the main administrative offices in Deraa, the southern area, and in Sweida, I believe it was, this Druze area, which should be allied with the Syrian regime.
Right.
The offices were burnt down because they have no electricity, very little electricity, no gas, no oil. People are hungry. And so it turned into, you know, a very anti-regime demonstration. The regime ended up shooting at the demonstrators, killing one person. One policeman was also killed, and a bunch were wounded. And it was a little flicker of hope for the people, the Syrian opposition is hoping that Assad will fall. Yeah. And it's things like that that lead the Kurds to say, you know, if you'll just support us for a few more years, maybe everything will change. So the Kurds don't want to just do about face, accept Assad back in and give up all of their hopes.
And the U.S., there's enough in the U.S. I mean, it seems the U.S. ideally would like to freeze things as it would like inertia, because doing a deal is not going to win anybody any political points in Washington. Because a deal is going to just mean ultimately legitimizing Assad and, you know, our Kurdish friend.
It would be a failure for America.
Exactly. It would be the final admission.
Biden would see this as a major failure on the level of Afghanistan.
Right, exactly.
Right.
Of course, it wouldn't be as big as Afghanistan because Afghanistan was such a major undertaking for the United States. But it would be another one. And the Republicans would bank this for national elections that are coming up. And they would say, look at this guy. Was supposed to be the foreign policy president, and he's a loser. Yeah, he's abandoned our allies in Afghanistan. He's abandoned them in Syria and the Kurds. And, you know, it's time to have a Republican administration.
Right. It's interesting, though. I think that, I'm just guessing, but my impression is that they tried that with Afghanistan. And, well, for several reasons, the first one being that Afghanistan was pretty obviously dead on arrival as a U.S. mission. That they tried that, and what they found is that people are sick of interventions and they don't really care that much. I think at the upper levels of the conservative establishment, there was outrage.
Well, in the liberal establishment, too. I mean, it was the whole...
Yeah, the New York Times crowd, too.
But, you know, it's funny about interventions. You bring up interventions, but the United States has, you know, there's been a new study, a wonderful study, on American interventions, in which there are about 400 U.S. interventions since the creation of the United States, 1776.
Yeah.
Half of them have been since World War II. But half of those, a quarter of all of our interventions, have been since the end of the Cold War, which is only a 30-year period, really, since 1990, a 32-year period. And the pace of interventions and some of the military impact has only grown. And this is sort of a bit of a conundrum, because with the collapse of the Soviet Union and no real threat to the homeland, why would the United States be intervening at such a furious pace and have increased the tempo of its interventions? And I suppose you know, the realist interpretation for that would be because it can.
Mm.
Because it's had this moment since 1990 of being the unique superpower.
Right.
It can intervene without worrying that the Soviet Union or China or anybody else is going to throw in arms and escalate and hurt them. Now, that world is changing today with the growth of China and with Russia sort of in Ukraine. And we're seeing what a multipolar world is going to be like. And I think that is what we're seeing here with Turkey pushing back and becoming a major power and being able to say no to the United States.
Yeah, I remember when I was a child, it was clear that NATO in itself was a vassal of the United States, and Turkey was one of the sub-vassals who made up that vassalage. And that's just not true anymore. I mean, Turkey has been acting independently for a long time.
Just saw Saudi Arabia do it. We just saw Saudi Arabia do it by inviting the Chinese there and having this love fest, really as an indication that they don't trust America and they don't have to say yes to America the way they used to. And America's going to have to be much more compliant. And that's what Erdogan in Turkey is counting on, is that he can push back, and the United States needs him against Russia, and they're going to have to cough up the Kurds.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that the U.S. does not want to have to turn Turkey into one of its axis of evil countries, that Turkey, for all of its problems, is still overall, first of all, it has very old, deep ties with the U.S. kind of military, national security state. It's a great, arms purchaser. And the idea of it becoming an enemy or something, or like a problem, it would just be, I would think that would be very problematic. And it seems Turkey doesn't want
America
that.
America can't allow that to happen.
It can't allow it, exactly. And it does, seems to me that Turkey doesn't want to be an enemy of the U.S. either. I mean, it's, you go back again, we went back to this history. It was Ataturk's saying was something like peace abroad, peace at home. In other words, don't ever get into a World War I. Don't pick sides anymore. And they're kind of, that now they can kind of have the best of both worlds, being in NATO, being very powerful in NATO, but also being very independent of NATO and sometimes pissing off what is NATO really, the U.S.
And neutrality, which has been so important, because in World War I, they picked sides and they were destroyed. In World War II, they stayed neutral and they were winners.
Right.
Oh, definitely. The French gave them the province of Hatay just for staying out.
Yeah.
If you don't join Hitler, we'll give you this province. It's got a coastline. It's very nice.
Yeah, that's the lesson.
And they avoided any, real damage in the costs of war, and everybody around them was leveled. So they came out of that, smelling like a rose. And that lesson has not been lost on the Turks, and they've been practicing it in this Ukraine war with studied...
it's been pretty impressive. I mean, in a dark, cynical way, but he's gotten really good at it. But I heard, again, we talked a little bit about this professor, Ryan Gingeris, who's written several books on Turkey and the Ottomans. And his interest in Turkey first started, I think, maybe in the 90s. He became sort of a Turkophile and then got into the history and the culture and eventually, PhD and all that stuff and that. And he said that Turks then loved Americans. And I think that had been the case generally, maybe not left-wing Turks so much, but as a general kind of rule, they had loved Americans. And what really changed it, that he personally, at least from his personal observations, and then also from, political speeches and platforms, was the Iraq invasion and the way the Bush administration, if we remember, wound up really alienating Turkey in that invasion. And it's never really, that relationship has never really recovered for a variety of reasons since then.
Let me jump in there, because the reason that Turkey got so upset at the United States during the invasion of Iraq and forbid U.S. troops from coming through Turkey was because the U.S. wanted to pursue the same strategy in Iraq that it's pursuing today in Syria, which is to team up with the Kurds in the north of the country, use them as a proxy army, and come through northern, you know, arming the Kurds and coming through northern Iraq to destroy Saddam Hussein.
Right.
Turkey said, no, we're not going to allow you to do that, because then the Kurds are going to get armed and trained by you, and they're going to, and then our Kurds in the eastern part of Anatolia will break away and try to join them. So Turkey said no, and some of the neocons in the Bush administration said we should overthrow.
I know.
We should overthrow the Turkish regime. And this is one of the reasons why Erdogan, in when that failed coup took place in 2016, blamed the United States, because the United States had threatened them in the same way earlier on.
That's a brilliant point. I hadn't realized that. Yeah. I hadn't realized the Kurdish connection to that.
It was because of the Kurdish connection. Yes. And that's what in America has kept on siding with the Kurds, in a sense, against Turkey. That's the way the Turks see it. Of course, America doesn't see it that way. They say, you know, we're trying to be pro-human rights and get our way and stop dictatorship in the Middle East. But for Turkey, supporting Kurds and giving, you know, fanning the flames of Kurdish nationalism, which could, you know, rekindle civil war in Turkey, or God forbid, the breaking away of the eastern provinces, that's what terrifies Turkey. And so they see this as, you know, America being on the wrong side.
Then I have to ask, why did Erdogan decide to go all in on the regime change against Assad when he had a deal worked out with him in the 90s to, you know, to mutually suppress the Kurds?
Well, that's a great question. And he dragged his feet. He dragged his feet on doing that when America first pushed him and said, look, because as you recall, President Obama didn't want to be, you know, taking the lead in Syria. And he said, we'll lead from behind. And in saying that, he wanted Saudi Arabia and Turkey, primarily Turkey, to be the lead force and to send his army in and to move against Assad. And Erdogan said, you know, he was loath to do that. And he went and met with Assad, and he talked with him and said, you know, you need to leave. And Assad said, forget it, I'm not leaving. And then Turkey came around to thinking, you know, Assad is going to fall. And that was the mistake, of course, that everybody in the West made, because they thought, this guy's a goner. And let's just jump in and do this. And I can create the kind of government in Syria that I have here, an Islamist sort of Muslim Brotherhood government that'll be much more convivial, and it didn't work out.
That's pretty grim stuff. So how would you see the relationship in Syria between Russia and Turkey? Because, you know, back in 2015, when Russia first overtly intervened on the side of the Assad regime, the SAA, Turkey and NATO and the US, everybody sort of really went ballistic. And then Turkey shot down a Sukhoi in like October, November of 2015. It seemed almost like there might be a war. And then they kind of worked out a very cold peace. And even before the Ukraine war, though, there seems to be that I can't say I fully grasp. I guess the best way to put it would be a very practical relationship where they seem to kind of have layers of understandings with each other. They're not allies and they're not enemies, and they seem to be able to work together pretty well. I mean, as you pointed out, Turkey's become a very important sort of gateway for Russia to instill trade with the rest of the world. And Russia's invested billions of dollars into the Turkish banking system through this nuclear reactors that they're going to build, but that have kind of helped prop up the lira. I mean, they have very strange, interesting, deep ties. And how is that manifesting itself in Syria lately?
Well, you're absolutely right. The trade between Turkey and the United States used to be much greater than the trade between Soviet Union and Turkey. And after the fall of the Soviet Union, that balance began to shift, and now it's shifted very dramatically. And Turkish trade with Russia is immense.
Right.
It's on a level of 30 something billion dollars. And they've met recently, the leaders, and said we were going to increase that dramatically. And we're going to make Turkey a hub for oil and gas for the region. Putin has put on the charm campaign to try to win Erdogan over. And they like each other because they're both strongmen. Mm-hmm. This whole, you know, sort of America has been beating the drums, or at least certain parts of America, saying that Erdogan should no longer be our ally. He's not trustworthy. He's too mm-hmm. Islamist. He's a dictator. All those things that shoves Turkey closer to Russia. Yes, there was that moment in 2015 when Turkey shot down a Russian jet that had flown just for a brief incandescent moment over the border in northern Syria into Turkish territory, which gave Turkey an excuse to shoot it down because they were defending Assad against the Turkish-backed rebels. And Turkey immediately switched to NATO and the United States and said, look, you have to back me up here if Russia threatens me. And America said, no, we're not going to back you up. You
right.
need to patch this up. You know, that was, one of the stark moments that many right-wing Turks point to today to say, America never had our back.
Right.
And we've got to, we're not going to, you know, NATO is not a dependable partner. And America is not a dependable partner. But Russia and Turkey have become closer and closer. Now, that's strained today by the Ukrainian war. It's become much more transactional. And as we know, Turkey gave a lot of its drones to Ukraine and is building drones conjointly with Ukraine.
Yes.
So
why,
that's
though?
That's
I mean, to ask a naive question, why did they make that choice?
Why
to
did
not
Turkey?
Take sides, right? I mean, to be neutral.
Well, because it's so profitable. It's
right.
so
okay.
profitable to play both sides against, you know, the middle. And they're doing that in places like Libya. They're doing that against Greece and in the ocean for gas exploration rights. Mm-hmm. Turkey is being able to push both sides. So as long as they need, as NATO hasn't kicked them out, because if NATO kicked Turkey out and began seeing Turkey as an enemy, Russia would be able to squeeze Turkey.
Yeah.
And Turkey's really got it coming on both sides. They can make super deals to get discounted oil, to get all the banking stuff done cheaply with both sides.
Yeah,
that makes sense. And clearly, when you listen to the U.S. elite now, Ukraine is the utterly dominant priority for them. So presumably, Turkey gains creds with the U.S. if it's willing to do Ukraine a favor or two.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, America is just focused on its European alliance, which is at the center of its world power and its authority and its legitimacy as a democratic power, having this coalition in NATO and the Europeans. And Ukraine is testing that because of the cost and the energy and the sanctions on Russia and getting the Europeans really to see Russia as an enemy again and America as its main ally has been, you know, I think one of the high points of the Biden administration, really, that it can point to. At the same time, it really needs to get a win in Ukraine and it needs to keep the Europeans close and supply this oil and not throw the world economy out of kilter. And so focusing on Europe, I think, has really given, you know, it's given Turkey a lot of leverage.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Pulling the camera, I guess, in a different direction. I mean, you have, you know, through your in-laws, you have roots there in Syria itself, and you know Syrian people. And everything we're hearing, they're really suffering there. The sanctions, I mean, talk about sanctions. I mean, Syria is not Russia, where you can slap these so-called nuclear sanctions, but they have so many resources that they can still keep things propped up. So could you just tell us a bit about sort of the domestic situation economically and politically, like how solid is Assad and how bad are things for Syrians?
First, things are just terribly bad for Syrians. And, you know, we hear a lot about Lebanon and the travails and economic privation since the collapse of their banking system and their currency
right.
2 years ago. But Syria is infinitely worse. And they took a big battering because they collapsed this banking system, which drove their currency right through the floor. But I'll give you a few examples, which is that electricity comes on about an hour a day.
Wow.
All over Syria. And people can't, you know, people used to have generators and be able to make up for that if they had a little money. But today you can't find the oil and the, you know, the diesel or whatever is going to run your generator. People can't buy it for love or nor money. And it's just not there because the ships have not been getting to Syria. Syria doesn't have the foreign currency. Their national budget, the government's budget this year, I think is about $4 billion Jeez. If you convert it into black market. And it used to be $50 billion wow. before
That's
the
insane.
War. So it has collapsed to one-tenth. And the people don't have, you know, they're just scratching out an existence. And right now it's cold in Syria, very cold, and particularly in mountain areas and others. And people are freezing. And we're reading these terrible stories about mothers who can't, you know, they're sending their kids to an aunt who has for 1 week where she will run, heat the house, and then they come to hers. And they can't get enough energy. And that's why, and food prices have gone through the roof. So people are really suffering. No, that's the dilemma. And the Assad government can't fix it. It's locked in this unvirtuous cycle where it keeps on falling. And it's, you know, it's printing money and trying to buy oil that way. But of course, that creates more inflation. And so it's really, but, you know, the hope of the people who support sanctions on Syria and keeping it isolated and denying it fuel, the hope of those people is that the Syrian people will rise up and overthrow the government.
Wasn't that tried in 2011 through 2018? I mean,
yeah, it's been tried. You know, that's what people are hoping in Iran, but it's not going to work.
I think there's another element to that too, even if it's not spoken out loud many times, which is at least we'll make them suffer.
Yeah,
and
spite.
I think that's a real factor.
Yeah.
It is, but you know, as I've watched Russia bomb the infrastructure of Ukraine, taking out the electricity, taking out water, it's not, of course, it's different than what the United States is doing to Syria because sanctions are different. They're not bombing. But it has a similar effect, which is to try to destroy the infrastructure and deny basic needs of Syrians, whether it's energy or electricity. And, you know, American government officials always come back to me and say, oh, but we're the largest donors of aid to Syrians. Yeah. And, you know, they've given about $2 billion a year or something like that. But it's a drop in the bucket to choking off the economy. And it's a good line, you know, for publicity, but it doesn't, it's just a mean, it's just
very
a mean
cynical.
Policy that is, yes, very cynical.
I know this is just paradisical thinking, but golly, it seems like a good platform on which to build a settlement between the eastern Syrian areas that have oil and the western Syrian areas that have people who need oil. Like if the U.S. and Turkey could just now be taken off the board, which of course they can't. So
no, but I think we're going to see exactly that. I think we're going to see eventually that Turkey wants Assad to control that border again. And that was the deal they had in 1997. It's called the Adana Agreement. And Turkey could go in hot pursuit 5 kilometers across the border against PKK elements. But it could only stay for, I think, 24 or 48 hours, and it had to withdraw again. But that essentially, Syria was going to protect its borders and make sure there was no guerrilla activity across them that would threaten Turkey. And that, you know, that agreement is going to be reestablished because it's the only one that makes sense.
Yeah.
And America should facilitate it because ultimately it's going to let down the Kurds and it doesn't, it can't stay there forever. The Kurdish part of Syria cannot sustain itself. It's poor. There are only 2 million Kurds in Syria and they can't form a nation on their own.
Yeah.
So ultimately America is going to withdraw and Turkey and Syria are going to have to figure this out. The big sticking point between any Turkish-Syrian agreement is this Afrin and Idlib area that we've mm-hmm. talked about, which
yes,
has about 4 million Syrian refugees and all of these militias that right. got mm-hmm. driven out of the rest of Syria into this really holding zone. It's fairly large, but it's dominated by Turkey. Mm-hmm. And Syria says, we can make a deal about the Kurds and other things, but you have to give that territory back to me.
Right.
And that mm-hmm. would mean that all these Turkish allies get pounded.
Yeah.
And many of them would want to flee into Turkey, and Turkey just right. doesn't want more Syrian Syrian refugees. And so that's the big sticking point. But ultimately, right. that's got to be solved.
How yeah. can it be solved? What do you think?
That's a stickler, and I don't yeah. really have an answer for it. You know, my hunch is that bad things are going to happen there, that Assad's going to take it over and Turkey's going to give it up, much the way that America is going to give up the Kurds mm. and allow Assad to move back in there eventually. And that means that some of those people are going to have to flee. And the United States and Turkey, who supported them and armed them and trained them, is going to have to find a way for them to leave. Mm-hmm. Unless they want to have happen to them what happened in Afghanistan, which is just to say, you know, forget it. We can't do it to all of you. Mm-hmm. And that's a very difficult way.
I mean, when
it's
you look at this...
Because Al-Qaeda yeah. still has a big yes. presence there.
Yeah.
And who's going to take those people?
Yeah, I noticed that you said Turkey has been saying Hayat Tahrir al-Sham will not take part in this projected new offensive, but HTS seems to say, oh, yeah, we will.
Just put on a different uniform.
Yeah.
Right. they've been raising their little flag saying we can do, you know, we can help you with this because of course yeah. they want to be instrumental and take the leadership. And Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which is a renamed Al-Qaeda forces with some additional groups in. But they've cut their relationship probably fairly, they probably have altered their relationship with Al-Qaeda Central in important ways, but they're the same people.
Right.
And they're hard-bitten Salafists. And they have moved into Afrin, they moved into some of these other parts of Turkish-dominated Syria and beaten up Arab militias that Turkey was supporting there. So they've flexed their muscles recently and shown what a dominant force they are in this entire region and how important they still are. And that's a complicating factor because they are the sworn enemies of Assad and Assad will not have any mercy for them. So trying to negotiate some kind of peace agreement with them and Assad is going to be next to impossible.
Yeah. I remember when the Afrin invasion was happening, you said there was even a possibility that that Erdogan might try to straight up annex some of this territory. But it sounds like that actually is not what you're saying now. That wouldn't be really to his advantage because what they want to do is actually move out all of the ethnic Arab or Syrian refugees and settle them somewhere that's essentially like a protectorate territory, but not their responsibility, direct responsibility. Yeah, is that right?
You're right. Yeah. I have switched my, Erdogan was so ambitious at the height of the Syrian war. He was making comments about the Ottoman Empire and that there are moments right. in history when you need a strong leader that change everything. The sort of the chessboard is rearranged. And this is one of those moments. So he was using this language, the pretentious language that the borders could change. Ottoman Empire, this is irredentism. We lost territory in Syria that should be part of
Antonia. Very Putin, by the way.
Very Putin-y.
Yeah.
And I think he's been humbled in some ways since then. And he's been humbled by a number of things. First, the elections have turned against him in Syria and in Turkey increasingly. Secondly, the economy is doing so badly in Turkey that Turks are furious at the Arabs. They've turned against the Arabs. And they were so supportive of the Arab refugees for almost a decade.
I ran some furious-sounding Google exchanges between Arab and Turkish people about this through Google Translate, which is very helpful for this. And there's no love lost at the moment.
No.
Yeah.
It's a little bit like the Trumpism against the Mexicans at the height of that, where, Turks are now calling them rapists and criminals and so forth.
Wow.
And just 5 years, 6 years ago, they were saying, no, these are our brothers, Muslims, so forth. We've got to help us. That's horrible. And so things have changed. And that's driven by the economy, which has gone south in Turkey.
Right.
So Erdogan, because elections are coming up next year, for Erdogan, and he's very worried about it. And the opposition is all saying, we've got to send these people home to Assad. The opposition is saying, we're going to make peace with Assad. Erdogan was stupid and led Turkey into this terrible pit by taking on Assad. He made a mistake. It was wrong. And we're going to change that. So Erdogan is being chased by his opposition into a much more tentative position. And a willingness to talk to Assad.
That's interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
We kept you for a while. This is just such a great, fascinating interview. And, it's hard to leave off because it's a frustrating story, too.
There's so many little vectors leading into it.
Yeah. And it's hard, and it's, you want to sort of, get closure, as they say, and it's really impossible.
Right.
I mean, people have to remember the Syrian war, at least for the West, was the center of the foreign policy world for the previous decade.
For a decade. It's true.
And it's just off the map, gone. Right?
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
You could probably find four or five people in Washington who are still really following the Syria story. They've all been seconded towards, other.
Yeah. Well, it's particularly frustrating if you're trying to find out what's happening in Tigray, because that was like the world's biggest war that never made it to the front page at all.
Yeah.
Well, it's like the Congo and all these things that were, where 3 million people were being killed. And it wasn't, most people were totally unaware of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it sounds like, looking forward, I mean, it sounds like this is going to be resolved. If it is, if we're going to move to the next stage, it's really going to be resolved by Turkey making a move to resolve things with Assad and come to some sort of agreement. And it seems like all the parties are kind of moving that way. But for the U.S., for political reasons, inertia is the kind of goal, keeping things as they are and hoping something better. I mean, for America, the ideal situation is Assad somehow has to leave office and then they get to declare some kind of victory and then forget about it, like Libya or something. But it sounds to me like the most likely scenario is the one you developed, which is, and the one we should look out for, is that kind of rapprochement or understanding and settlement between Turkey and Syria, Assad and Erdogan. Does that sound right?
I think you're absolutely correct. I just can't see any forces that are going to overthrow Assad.
Yeah.
And Syrian society is too weak. There's no opposition today, organized opposition. And that's the big problem for American foreign policy. They've stuck to this mantra that they're going to somehow change the status quo in Syria. And they're not. And they've kept sanctions on, hoping that some rabbit would pop out of the hat. But it's not going to happen. The Arab states and the Middle Eastern states are all coming to the, the grim realization that this is the way it's going to be. And we have to deal with reality. We can't just keep on wishing for some rabbit.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Joshua Landis. Another great interview. And we'll be back after some music. Okay, that was music by our man, Brendan Anderegg. You can, I'll post a link to his albums. We've talked about, I mean, people often ask, hey, where does that music come from? Where can I get it? So we'll post a link to Brendan's music. And anyway, wrapping it up, John, I mean, it's, you know, anytime we talk about the Serie War, it's always been pretty damn grim. And it seems like we all know what has to happen and it's going to be ugly. And the U.S., I mean, it's sort of like the U.S. knew it. The U.S. knew that the war in Afghanistan was lost about 12 or 13 years before it actually withdrew. And Biden, you know, I it's hard to say how much he suffered from it. When you look at poll numbers, because there was such a media blitz against him that had never been seen before, it did affect his poll numbers for a bit. And then they kind of, and then everybody who claimed to say, you know, how could we do this to the women and children? Then they just moved on to something else and didn't care when it turned out that.
And I think it was a big split between elite opinion and ordinary people's opinion. Ordinary people, because they have this vague jingoism, like, you know, most people in most countries do have, they didn't like the military humiliation aspect. But as far as real concern about leaving Afghanistan, I think it was around zero.
No, but to your point about ordinary people, when they, there was some saline anecdote from a book written about him by this fan of his, this Jewish professor at Brandeis, who made the mistake of going to meet his hero. You never do that, especially with somebody like Saline, who was a pretty horrible person, particularly to Jews. And he kind of thought, I'll find the, you know, the heart of gold within that monster. And there wasn't one. But anyway, there were some great lines in their meeting. And Saline basically had this anecdote about some professor at the Sorbonne who's, you know, lectured for decades and written books about world civilizations and what mattered and high civilization, low, and all this stuff. And then when he finally retired from the Sorbonne, he traveled the world for the first time, came back and said, everything I wrote my entire career is pure hokum, pure bunk. The only thing that matters to every civilization is the last war you've won and the next war you will win. And yeah, that's, you know, so there is that. And it's been a long time since the U.S. won a war, hasn't it? Anyways, all right, on that wretched note, I think we could end the episode. Thank you again to Joshua Landis. We'll post links to his Twitter feed, which is always like a
link to great stories. Follow Joshua Landis on Twitter if you're on Twitter. If you're still doing the Twitter thing, because it's a great way to see what's going on in Syria, even when the media don't seem very interested.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, John, Joshua.
Thanks, everybody.
Brendan. Bye-bye.
All right.